Welcome to the first of the summer lecture series. My name is Charles Jeremy, and I'm representing the Cornell University summer session, and it's a pleasure to have you here. Michael Burlingame has been the Chancellor Naomi B. Lynn Distinguished Chair in Lincoln Studies at the University of Illinois at Springfield since 2009. As a freshman at Princeton University, he enrolled in a Civil War course taught by the eminent Lincolnian David Herbert Donald, who took Michael under his wing and made him an undergraduate research assistant. When Professor Donald moved on to Johns Hopkins University, Michael, upon graduation, followed to earn his PhD degree there. In 1968, Michael joined the history department at Connecticut College, where he taught until retiring as the May Buckley Sadowski Professor of History Emeritus in 2001, in order to write his biography of Abraham Lincoln, to which I will refer later. Michael's first book, The Inner World of Abraham Lincoln, was described by reviewers as, and these are quotes, a revelation, a triumph, the most convincing portrait of Lincoln's personality to date. An Oral History of Abraham Lincoln, John G. Nicolay's Interviews and Essays, one of his 12 volumes of edited Lincoln primary source materials, if I counted correctly, something like that, was awarded the prestigious Abraham Lincoln Association Book Prize. His two-volume, 2,000-page Abraham Lincoln, A Life, published by Johns Hopkins University Press in 2008, was described in one review as, quote, the most meticulously researched Lincoln biography ever written, and one that, quote, supersedes all other biographies. Doris Kearns Goodwin wrote of it, Lincoln scholars have awaited anxiously for this book for decades. Its triumphant publication proves it was well worth the wait. Few scholars have written with greater insight about the psychology of Lincoln. No one in recent history has uncovered more fresh sources than Michael Burlingame. This profound and masterful portrait will be read and studied for years to come. Abraham Lincoln, A Life, won the 2010 Lincoln Prize, sponsored by the Gilder Lehrman Institute for American History and Gettysburg College, for the finest scholarly work in English on Abraham Lincoln. And that was the category. It was a co-winner of the annual book prize awarded by the Abraham Lincoln Institute of Washington, D.C., and it won the Russell P. Strange Book Award given annually by the Illinois State Historical Society for the best book on Illinois history. The text of Abraham Lincoln, A Life, in its entirety, resides at the Knox College website, where it will be corrected and expanded as new information is found. And the website now weighs 10 pounds. Among other awards, Michael has also received the Lincoln Diploma of Honor from Lincoln Memorial University, and he was inducted into the Lincoln Academy of Illinois. He is presently working, not surprisingly, on several Lincoln-related projects. Michael Burlingame, Lincoln's Emotional Life.
Well, thank you for that very kind introduction, and thank you all for coming. I'm awfully glad to be here. I relish every opportunity I can get to speak about my favorite subject without having to grade any of your papers or exams. So, now, I thought I might tell you a little bit about how I became a Lincoln scholar before I get into my formal remarks, and it's partly, as Bud suggested, because of my experience as a college freshman when David Donald took me under his wing. But I think I was predisposed to be a Lincoln scholar even before those undergraduate days, partly because I was born and raised in Washington, D.C. This was just slightly after the unfortunate event at Ford's Theater. I don't mean to joke about my age. I'm 70, but I prefer to think of it as 21 Celsius. Feel free to use that. I stole it from Tom Lehrer. In addition, I think I was predisposed to become a Lincoln scholar because one of my ancestors, Anson Burlingame, who was my great-grandfather's cousin, was Lincoln's ambassador to China. So there's a slight connection there. But I think most important in shaping my decision to become a Lincoln Scholar was an episode that occurred between my junior and senior years at college. That summer, I had a job at the Library of Congress working in the manuscript division, which is the mecca for all serious original research in American history. And the person who had obtained that job for me was the chairman of the history department at Princeton, where I was an undergraduate. And he himself spent his summers at the Library of Congress working on a magisterial history of European economic development. And he would regularly swing by the manuscript division where I was employed at noontime and invite me to join him and his friends for lunch. Well, it was a very heady experience for a callow youth of 20 Fahrenheit, as I then was. So it's very exciting. I'd sit down at lunch with six or seven or eight eminent historians of Europe and America. And one day, a bunch of us were at the Library of Congress cafeteria eating lunch, and one fellow started to talk about Douglas Southall Freeman. Now, Freeman, as some of you probably know, was an eminent journalist and historian who wrote a four-volume biography of Robert E. Lee and a three-volume study of Lee's lieutenants. And at the end of his life, he was writing a multi-volume biography of George Washington. And this historian said, a funny thing about Freeman, as each of the volumes of the Washington biography appeared, you could detect changes in the author. He began to adopt Washington's gestures and Washington's mannerisms. And he began to speak in 18th century locutions. And toward the end, he even began to look like George Washington. Well, I straightened up my bow tie and slicked back my hair and said, well, when I graduate, I'm going on to pursue a PhD in the Civil War and Reconstruction, and people have told me that I look like Abraham Lincoln. At which point, my chairman banged his fist on the table, and all the knives and forks and spoons leapt up into the air, and they came clattering back down to the green formica-clad tabletop, creating a ruckus that caused people all around us to look about to see what the noise was all about. And my chairman announced in a voice that could have been heard in Baltimore if the door had been open, he said, "Holy mackerel, Mike, you're ugly, but you're not that ugly." And I think ever since that day, I knew I was fated to be a Lincoln Scholar. And one of the great things about being a Lincoln Scholar is that Lincoln had a tremendous sense of humor. And when you do research on Lincoln, you're bound to run into funny stories that he told or were told about him. And one day years ago, I was doing some research in reminiscences written by people who had known him. And I was in the New York Public Library in the main reading room. And as some of you doubtless know, it's a huge room, beautiful room, but it's always packed. So there were people all around me. I was at a table, and there was somebody across from me, and people to my right and left and behind and everywhere. And as I was going through these reminiscences of people who had known Lincoln, I, about a half hour into my work, encountered a funny story. And without stopping to think where I was, I burst out laughing. And everybody around me went, shh, shh, shh. I said, oh, excuse me, forgive me. So I went back to work and continued reading reminiscences, and another half hour or so passes, and once again, I encounter a funny story. And once again, without thinking where I was, I burst out laughing. And once again, everybody around me, with a little more emphasis this time, said, shh, shh, shh. I said, sorry, forgive me. Well, it happened a third time. At which point, the woman sitting directly across from me at this big table, who was very earnest looking, she was about my age, and she had her hair back in a tight bun and no makeup and wire-rimmed glasses, and she was taking notes from a large tome of sociology. She leaned across the table, and she fixed me with her gaze, and she said, "Just what is your field anyhow? I think I'm going to switch to it." it calls to mind the scene in the movie When Harry Met Sally, the delicatessen, I'll have what she's having. I remember that one. Okay, well, enough levity. Let's get down to business here. Lincoln's emotional life. Well, when I wrote my first book called The Inner World of Abraham Lincoln, it was a self-consciously psychological study. And I am a psychohistorian. That's one word. There are psychohistorians, that's two words, that I flatter myself I don't belong to that category, although not everybody I know would agree with that assessment. But and the book is a series of essays about Lincoln's inner life, his relations with his parents, his relations with his wife, his relations with his children, his midlife crisis, his depressions, things of that sort. I wanted to call it Shrinkin' Lincoln, but my publisher wouldn't let me. So what I tried to do in that book and then expanded on that idea in my big 2,000-page biography, which, by the way, is called Abraham Lincoln, A Life. Be sure to buy it. You don't have to read it, but be sure to buy it. Is to connect the inner life with the public life. And there is a lot of light that can be shed on the behavior and thought of public figures if you know something about their private lives. And let me give you a couple of examples. One of the striking features of Lincoln's early life was that he and his father did not get along at all well. Lincoln's father was opposed to Lincoln's education. And by the way, Lincoln's education was extremely limited. He himself said that if you added up all of the formal schooling that he had, a little bit here and a little bit there over the years, it would amount to less than 12 months. That is a very sobering statistic for those of us in the education business. And so Lincoln's father didn't want his son to be wasting his time reading and writing and pursuing school. And frequently, Lincoln's father would pull his adolescent son out of school in order to work for neighbors. That is, Lincoln's father was rather improvident, and he oftentimes carelessly agreed to endorse loans that his friends and neighbors contracted. And oftentimes those friends and neighbors defaulted on their loans. And so Lincoln's father was responsible for paying them off. So he would yank his son out of school and say, son, you go work for the neighbor. And the neighbor would pay young Abe maybe 25 cents a day for undertaking really backbreaking work. Digging up stumps, chopping down trees, killing snakes, building fences, really hard, brutal, physical work. And we shouldn't romanticize the life of rural farmers on the American frontier in the early 19th century. Horace Greeley, the leading newspaper editor of the day, once said that the life of farmers in those conditions was little better than that of an ox. You performed hard, physical labor. So, and Lincoln didn't like hard physical labor, surprisingly enough, and resented the fact that his father pulled him out of school and forced him to perform these chores. And that when Lincoln received his pay, 25 cents or so per day, he would take it home and he would turn it over to his father. That wasn't out of the goodness of his heart, that was because it was the law of the land. In the early 19th century, you were the property of your father until you became 21. Now, it may seem quaint to us in the 21st century to regard children as an economic asset. Let me repeat that. But that was in the days before orthodontia, private colleges like Connecticut College or Cornell University. So anyhow, So Lincoln performed these duties and turned over all the money to his father. Now, we know that Lincoln was deeply estranged from his father, partly because when Lincoln's father lay dying in the tiny community of Goose Nest Prairie, Illinois, that's not a figment of Garrison Keillor's imagination, there really is such a place, Lincoln received a letter, not by his father was illiterate, but from Lincoln's stepbrother, who was living with his father. And the stepbrother writes to Lincoln, who at that time was living in Springfield, about 100 miles away. Lincoln was in his early 40s, saying, "Our father is dying and would like to see you now." And Lincoln writes back, "Tell our father that it would be more painful than pleasant if we were to see each other now." This is pretty strong language, because no matter how estranged a child may be from a parent, the imminence of death usually acts as a solvent on that estrangement, but not in Lincoln's case. So he didn't go to his father on his father's deathbed. And then Lincoln was the only one in the family who had much money, and he was the only one who could afford to have a gravestone placed on his father's gravesite, but he did not do that. On top of that, Lincoln did not name a son after his father, at least for the first three sons who were born to the Lincolns. The Lincolns, as you may know, had four children, all boys, and the first one was named after Mrs. Lincoln's father, Robert Todd Lincoln. And you would think the second son, would be named after Lincoln's father. But no, it was named after one of Lincoln's law partners and political allies, Edward. Then a third son comes along. You think, well, now perhaps Lincoln would obey the tradition of naming a son after his own father. But no, the third son was named after his wife's half-sister's husband. Then Thomas Lincoln, Lincoln's father, dies. And then a fourth son is born, and they do name it Thomas, Lincoln's father's name. But Lincoln's father did not know that his name would be carried on by a grandson. And besides, Lincoln almost never called his son Tom or Thomas. He called him Tad, famously, ostensibly because when he was born, he had a big head and a small body and therefore looked like a tadpole. But I think he called him Ted because he really didn't like the name Tom or Thomas. But in any event, so there's plenty of evidence that Lincoln was pretty severely estranged from his father. And I thought about that, and I said, well, that's a striking feature of his early life. How would that affect his later life? And I filed that in the back of my mind. And then when I was dealing with Lincoln's anti-slavery views and their evolution, I noticed a striking pattern, that when Lincoln spoke out against slavery, as he did many, many times in the 1850s and during his presidency, he didn't use the traditional arguments that most champions of the anti-slavery cause cited. He did not, for example, talk about the physical cruelty of slavery and the brutality to which slaves were subjected, the beatings and the whippings and the maimings and the like. That was a very powerful argument. It made a lot of converts to the anti-slavery cause. But Lincoln almost never mentions that aspect of slavery. Nor did Lincoln talk about the way in which slave families were broken up, how wives were sold away from husbands, and how children were sold away from parents. And that, too, was a very powerful anti-slavery argument, as evidenced by the popularity of Uncle Tom's Cabin, Harriet Beecher Stowe's novel, in which that is a prominent theme, and which became a huge bestseller. But Lincoln doesn't talk about that. Nor does Lincoln talk about the way in which slavery in the Old South created a kind of aristocracy of a planter class, which was an anomaly in a democratic republic. Lincoln doesn't talk about that either. Nor does he talk about the way in which civil liberties, freedom of speech, freedom of the press, freedom of assembly, are curtailed in the interests of slavery. If you dared to speak out against slavery in the Old South, you would be run out of town on a rail if you were lucky and killed if you were unlucky. Even in the North, there was a concerted effort to suppress anti-slavery utterances. In fact, in Illinois in 1837, when Lincoln was in the legislature, a gentleman who ran an anti-slavery newspaper in Alton, Illinois, was murdered by a mob in Illinois, not a slave state. Instead, Lincoln emphasized one argument over and over again. And I thought it was noteworthy that he did this to the virtual exclusion of all the other arguments that I just mentioned. And the argument that he used was that it was an outrage that slaveholders had perverted the word of God Almighty himself, who, upon expelling Adam from the Garden of Eden, said, "In the sweat of thy brow shalt thou eat thy bread." And Lincoln said, "It is a monstrous sacrilege that the slaveholders have rewritten the word of God Almighty himself to read, 'In the sweat of somebody else's brow shalt thou eat thy bread.' That it is profoundly wrong that somebody goes out and works in the hot sun all day, and somebody else derives all the profits thereof." And I thought, now why would Lincoln emphasize that argument so heavily? And then it occurred to me, as you doubtless have already inferred, that he was sensitive to this argument, which he didn't invent, by the way. It was a fairly common argument, but I thought it was noteworthy that he emphasized it so heavily, because he could identify with the slaves, and he could identify his father with the slaveholders. And I think that helps account for Lincoln's early decision to come out against slavery. Now, you will hear it sometimes said that Lincoln was a reluctant emancipator. Well, that's not true. Lincoln hated and loathed and despised slavery from the time he was young. And the evidence for this is pretty strong. When Lincoln was serving in the legislature as a youngster of 28, in his second term as an Illinois representative, he, along with the other members of the Illinois State Legislature, were asked to condemn the abolitionist movement. The abolitionist movement was just getting underway after having been very strong in the revolutionary period, had tended to die out, and then it was reborn in the 1830s. And southern state legislatures appealed to their colleagues in the north, saying, "Please condemn the abolitionist movement." Well, the Illinois state legislature complied. And in the Illinois House of Representatives, where Lincoln sat, 77 members voted to condemn abolitionism, and only 6 had the nerve to go against the tide. And one of those 6 was Abraham Lincoln. Of those 6, 2 went a step further, showing even more courage. And they circulated a statement, which was then entered into the books of the Illinois House of Representatives, in which it was stated that slavery is based on injustice and bad policy. And one of those 2 was Abraham Lincoln, and he wrote it. The other fellow who signed it was from Vermont. Lincoln was from Kentucky. The other fellow who signed it was not standing for re-election. He had been appointed a judge and was about to assume his judicial duties. So Lincoln, as a youngster of 28, in 1837, well before abolitionism was popular, stuck his neck out. Then when Lincoln served in the United States Congress in his late 30s, he announced that he was going to introduce a bill to abolish slavery in the District of Columbia. At the time, Congress was considering measures to abolish slave trading in the District of Columbia, but not slavery itself. So Lincoln went a step much further than his colleagues. His bill was originally supported by 15 leading citizens of Washington, but when Southerners threatened to break up the Union if such legislation were passed, those 15 supporters withdrew their support for Lincoln's bill, and Lincoln withdrew the bill. But he was willing to stick his neck out again on the slavery issue. Now, where does that come from? Well, it doesn't come from his background growing up in an area where anti-slavery sentiment was imbibed from the air he breathed. He didn't grow up in New England. If he'd grown up in Connecticut or Vermont, it wouldn't be so surprising that Lincoln hated and loathed and despised slavery from early on. But he grew up in Kentucky, a slave state. And when he was 7 years old, he and his family moved to southern Indiana. And that was basically transplanted Kentucky. You couldn't take your slaves with you across the Ohio River from Kentucky to Indiana, but you can take your pro-slavery views, which most people did. So Lincoln, from the age of 7 to 21, is living in southwestern Indiana. He's not imbibing anti-slavery views from the atmosphere. Then he moves to central Illinois. Central Illinois is also a hotbed of Kentuckians. They bring with them their pro-slavery attitudes and values. Lincoln is running for office. He's an aspiring politician. You try to curry favor with the voters. And yet, there was no way that Lincoln was going to curry favor by sticking his neck out on the slavery issue. He didn't get his anti-slavery views from his in-laws. He married a woman from Kentucky whose father was a prominent slaveholder. So, the answer to the question of where Lincoln's anti-slavery views came from, why was he so opposed to slavery so early on, is, I think, illuminated by the study of Lincoln's relation with his father, that he hated slavery because he hated the way his father treated him. Now, my traditional historian friends would say, well, all that psychohistory is very interesting, but where's your evidence? Historians tend to be collectively from Missouri, which is healthy. They say, show me, what's your evidence? And what they would really like to see is a diary entry in which Lincoln says, "You know, dear diary, today I decided to come out against slavery because I realized that my father treated me like a slave and therefore..." But psychohistorical evidence, by its very nature, doesn't admit of such proof. But there are some pieces of evidence which do tend to suggest that this hypothesis that I have just developed for you is in fact true. A letter that Lincoln wrote in which he described a broken romance about how he courted a woman from Kentucky and how that romance fell apart shed some light on this subject. Because Lincoln says that he had gotten engaged to this woman, promised to marry her, and then he got buyer's remorse, cold feet, and he said he really didn't want to follow through on it. And he said, in this letter describing the courtship, he said, "There is no form of bondage, real or imaginary, that I have ever been in from which I more longed to escape." He's a real romantic guy, right? So what's he saying there? He says, "I know what it's like to be a slave. I know what it's like to be in bondage." Well, I don't think people use metaphors randomly, that oftentimes figures of speech are revealing of inner states below the rational surface of the ego. And there's another piece of evidence. In the 1850s, Lincoln, according to one reminiscence, gave a speech in which he said, one of the problems with slavery is that it doesn't allow black people to rise. Now, my friend out there, John Roll, he used to be a slave, but now he's a successful merchant. And I used to be a slave, but I'm a lawyer. Well, black people can't do that. And I thought that phrase, "I used to be a slave," was quite striking. Now, one of the problems with that piece of evidence is that it's a reminiscence. And historians tend to be skeptical of reminiscences because memory can play tricks on people. As Mark Twain once said, "The older I get, the more vividly I remember things that never happened." And that's true. You have to use reminiscent testimony with care. And the best way to do that is to compare it to contemporary evidence, not something that people remember 10, 20, 30 years after the event. But if you take that statement, which was recalled, "I used to be a slave," and then compare it to the letter in which Lincoln says, "There is no form of bondage, real or imaginary, that I've ever been in, from which I more long to escape," then it seems plausible. And again, my traditional historian friends say, "Well, come on, Michael, those are only just two pieces of evidence. That's not enough." I say, okay, what's your explanation? Why would Lincoln, having been born in Kentucky, having been raised in Southwest Indiana, having competed for office in Central Illinois, why in the world would he have come out so strongly against slavery? What's, and they just say, I don't know. So anyhow. So that's one aspect of Lincoln's emotional life that I think is particularly noteworthy. Another aspect of Lincoln's emotional life, which I think has some profound effect on his public life, is his marriage. Now, everything you've heard about Mary Todd Lincoln and how difficult and ornery and impossible she was is inaccurate. She was worse. It's an unbelievable story. And when my book first came out, my first book was The Inner World. It came out in 1994. It was an extraordinary, it was a national news story. I couldn't believe it. It was picked up on the AP, and it was on the CBS Morning News and the ABC Morning News and wire services. And it's because two pages in that book dealt with an aspect of the Lincoln marriage. There's a big chapter on the marriage, but only two pages dealt with this particular theme. And that is that Lincoln was physically abused by his wife. Now, that might seem implausible on the surface of it because he was 6'4" and strong, and she was 5'2" and not strong. But there is so much evidence of her physically abusing him, of striking him in the face and drawing blood, of chasing him out of the house with a knife, chasing him out of the house throwing books at him, chasing him out of the house throwing potatoes at him, cursing him in public. There's so much evidence about this kind of behavior from servants who worked in the household, from neighbors who lived in next door or near to the Lincoln home, from children who played in the neighborhood, from business associates, from legal associates, from political allies, that it can't be dismissed as just gossip and rumors. In addition, Mrs. Lincoln was, as First Lady of the land, engaged in all kinds of corruption. She accepted bribes, she accepted kickbacks, she padded payrolls, she padded expense accounts, she sold pardons, she sold cotton trading permits. It was astounding how corrupt her action was, particularly compared to his action, which was quite the opposite. And Lincoln tells one of his friends that there was nothing that he feared more than having his wife disgrace him publicly. And she did, because some of these stories leaked out during the Civil War and became a campaign issue in the 1864 presidential election when Lincoln was running for a second term. Now, one of the questions I had to deal with is how Lincoln happened to marry Mary Todd. And that's a tough question to answer. We don't know for sure why. Lincoln told people that he didn't love her enough to marry her. He told his best man, well, there were two groomsmen, he told one of the groomsmen that he was forced to marry her. Then he was asked where he was going on his wedding day. To hell, I guess, he said. It was said that in the household where he boarded, one of the children said that he looked like an animal going to the slaughter rather than a bridegroom on the way to his wedding. Well, I'm told that a lot of men look that way, but I can't vouch for that. So why did he marry her? Well, in fact, she did have some attractive features to a man like Lincoln. He was very well educated for the time. She had gone to a private school in which French was spoken exclusively. She was a personal friend of Henry Clay, who was the dominant figure in American public life at that time, and was Lincoln's beau ideal of a statesman. Lincoln admired Henry Clay above all other public figures. She could talk politics, she could talk poetry, she could talk literature, things Lincoln was interested in. So it's not entirely to be wondered at that there was some attraction. But Lincoln and she got engaged fairly early on in their courtship, but then he broke it off. He canceled the engagement. But then he felt terribly guilty about having promised to marry her and then having backed out of his promise. And so almost 2 years after having broken the engagement, he does finally marry her. And that's partly because he felt such a strong sense of a guilty conscience that he had made a promise and needed to stick to the promise. But also, I believe it's partly because she seduced him and said, "You've got to marry me because I may be pregnant." Now, we don't know that for sure. There's no hard evidence for it. You should pardon the expression. But it seems to me plausible, because the first child is born 8 months, 3 weeks, and 2 days after the wedding. Now, that doesn't in and of itself prove anything. But if you take that piece of evidence in conjunction with a statement to his best man and to other people that he didn't love her enough to marry her, that he felt like he was going to hell and so forth and so on, then it would make some sense. And she began to manifest signs of psychological instability early on in the marriage. Now, when you go to Springfield, you can see the Lincoln home, which is well worth a visit. But before they moved into that home, they lived in a boarding house for several months. And the rule of the boarding house was that none of the people staying there could start breakfast until all the other boarders were assembled. And Mrs. Lincoln was regularly late for breakfast. And all the other folks would be tapping their feet and impatiently awaiting the arrival of the final breakfast diner. And one day, Lincoln gently chided his wife for being tardy in arriving for breakfast, at which point she grabbed a cup of coffee off a tray, flung it in his face, and went screaming out of the room. Now, when I told my better half-to-be that story, she said, "Well, she was pregnant, wasn't she?" I said, "Well, yeah, but there are a lot of pregnant women who don't behave that way." So I think early on he recognized that she was mentally unstable. And in fact, I think it's pretty clear that she suffered from what we would today call bipolar disorder, manic depression. Because even her friends, when she was growing up, would say that she was either in the attic or in the cellar, that she was either very high or very low in spirits. And so Lincoln, when he was told about Mrs. Lincoln's padding of expense accounts, padding of payrolls, and the other ethical lapses that I mentioned earlier, said to the person who informed him, "I am convinced that the erratic behavior of my wife is the function of partial insanity." So I think he knew that early on. Now, what does this have to do with Lincoln and his public life? Is this just not People magazine sort of style gossip? Well, I think it's more than that. For one thing, Lincoln was famously a man of sorrows. And I think you cannot appreciate the depth of the sorrow that he experienced if you don't realize how troubled that marriage was. Try to imagine Lincoln with all of the responsibility that he bore as leader of the North during the Civil War, and then having to worry about his wife. His wife was not a source of comfort and repose, but a source of anxiety. Then again, Lincoln probably would not have become president if he had not married her. And that is because, in part, although he was ambitious, she was even more ambitious. She really wanted to be first lady of the land. And she goaded his ambition on. Now, as I say, he did not need her to instill some ambition in him. His ambition was like a rocket, but her ambition was like afterburners on the rocket. It really propelled it further than it might otherwise have gone. Another reason why Lincoln would not have become president without his wife's assistance is because she made life so miserable at home for him that he spent a great deal of time doing what we would call networking. He would look for any excuse to be out of the house. Lawyers in those days in Springfield couldn't make enough money simply by practicing law in the town of Springfield. So every spring and every fall, the lawyers and a judge would get together, and they would tour throughout the very large judicial circuit in central Illinois. And week after week, they would go to these county seats. The farmers would sue each other. And Lincoln and his part and his colleagues at the bar would undertake to represent both sides. And on the weekends, all the lawyers went home except Lincoln. He would rather stay in these dreary little hamlets in rural Illinois where nothing was going on Sunday rather than to go home to see his wife and children because she made life so difficult for him. When he was in Springfield for the rest of the year, he would look for excuses to be out at night to attend meetings of this organization or that organization or political caucuses or the like. And Lincoln's friends believed that if he had been happily married, he would never have gotten as far as he did because she would have made an attractive home, he would have been home a lot more often, and would not have established the kind of connections that eventually made his political success possible. And finally, I think the story of the Lincoln marriage, the unhappy story of the Lincoln marriage, it's important because Lincoln, as president, had an uncanny ability to deal with difficult people. When you see how he dealt with egomaniacs like senators, say Charles Sumner of Massachusetts, or congressmen like, say, Thaddeus Stevens of Pennsylvania, or generals like George McClellan, or editors like Horace Greeley, or any of a number of influential people, Lincoln showed an uncanny ability to get along with very difficult people. And I think part of the reason he was able to do that is because he had a lot of practice at home. A final aspect of Lincoln's emotional life that I would like to emphasize is Lincoln's transformation from a shallow hack politician, which he was more or less in his 20s and his 30s, to a great statesman in his 40s and his 50s. This is one of the striking features of Lincoln's development, is that as a young man in his 20s and his 30s, with the exception of those two episodes that I mentioned earlier, where Lincoln stuck his neck out on the slavery issue, Lincoln was pretty much a hack politician. He was a Whig, that is the party that preceded the Republican Party, and was gifted as a Whig speaker and legislator for one thing in particular, and that was his remarkable ability to ridicule and humiliate Democrats. He was very gifted in the arts of sarcasm, ridicule, so gifted that sometimes when he was involved in a debate with a Democratic opponent, he would ridicule that opponent so severely that the opponent would leave the stage, leave the rostrum, weeping because his feelings had been so deeply hurt. And Lincoln was, by the way, this was not uncommon, this style of politics. Lincoln didn't invent it. That was sort of standard brand frontier political discourse. But Lincoln was extremely good at it. And he so irritated one of his political opponents that the fellow challenged him to a duel. And it almost happened. Dueling was illegal in Illinois, but he and the person that he had offended went to Missouri, where dueling was legal, and they came within an ace of actually having the duel. So that was Lincoln in his 20s and his 30s. In his 40s and 50s, there was none of that. The second phase of Lincoln's political career sees him abandon sarcasm, ridicule, personal attacks. Instead, he becomes a high-minded champion of the anti-slavery cause. Now, we can see a little bit of that in the early phase of his career, but not much. Mostly he was a hack politician. But then at the age of 45, he is transformed. From the age of 40 to 45, there is a hiatus between these two phases of Lincoln's political career, the early 20s and 30s, and then the 40s and 50s. From the age of 40 to 45, Lincoln drops out of politics for all intents and purposes. He doesn't run for office. He had been running for office at every election cycle from the time of his age 23 up to age 40. Then he stops. But then from age 45 to 1850, to his death at the age of 56, he's running for office at every election cycle. So in those 5 years, he basically takes a time out. He's a practicing lawyer. He focuses more on his law career. And in those 5 years, he undergoes this tremendous transformation. When those 5 years are up, at the age of 45, he comes off the sidelines where he had been sitting for 5 years and re-enters politics a changed man. No more sarcasm, no more ridicule, no more personal attacks. High-minded, powerful, eloquent appeals to reason and political basic principles. So how did this happen? What accounts for this transformation? Well, it seems to me that Lincoln was a classic example of somebody who went through what we would today call a midlife crisis and came out of it successfully. Now, in the popular media, the midlife crisis tends to be trivialized by suggesting that it's really men running off with their secretaries in red sports cars and divorcing their wives. Well, that does sometimes happen. But the study of the midlife crisis that's been done by serious psychologists suggests that a large percentage of men in their early 40s go through a profound period of reassessing who they are, what they care about most, what they want to do with the rest of their lives. And men at this period oftentimes reflect on, have I made the right career choice? Have I made the right marital choice? Have I spent too much of my time and energy trying to please the collective instead of developing my own inner strengths? How have I hurt others? How have I been hurt by others? What do I want to leave as a legacy? What's truly important to me? And this isn't something you just think about one night. This is something that goes on year after year, and oftentimes it's not conscious. And out of this period of introspection and brooding and psychological turmoil, out of that can come tremendous psychological growth. Now, it doesn't always happen, and it's hard to know why some men go through this period of introspection and reflection and come out changed for the better. Some don't change at all, some change for the worse. But it seems to me in Lincoln's case, is one of the most dramatic examples in American public life of a man who goes through a midlife crisis and comes out a transformed man, a much more psychologically whole, rooted, and balanced adult. Now, how does this manifest itself? Well, obviously, Lincoln is a high road politician rather than a low road politician. He's psychologically mature, rooted, and balanced. Now, what do I mean by that? Well, one of the hallmarks of a person who is psychologically mature, balanced, and rooted is that he does not take things personally. That he manages to overcome the petty tyranny of the ego. Now, we all tend to have needy egos. That's particularly true of people in politics and show business. In fact, you may have heard politics described as show business for ugly people. Think Harry Reid, you know, think Mitch McConnell. And yet Lincoln managed to overcome that so that he would deal with people who would insult him, criticize his policies, criticize his appointments, criticize his appearance, criticize his background, criticize his lack of formal education, awful lot of criticism, and Lincoln wouldn't take it personally. He refused to quarrel. He refused to engage in personal disputes with people. He rose above it. And that, I think, is one of the secrets of his success as president, because the great challenge that the North faced was keeping all factions of political and geographic and ethnic and social groups working together. And that was a great challenge. The Republican Party, for example, had been recently formed. The Republican Party really gets underway in the mid-1850s. And it's made up of former Whigs and former Democrats who agreed that slavery was wrong and should not be allowed to expand. Now, these two elements were very volatile, very unstable, because the Whigs and the Democrats had hated each other. They had, in those days, the rivalries between the parties were extremely intense, more so than even than today. I spent much of my life in Connecticut, halfway between New York and Boston. So I know a lot of Yankee fans, and I know a lot of Red Sox fans. And trying to get them to cooperate with each other was like trying to get the Whigs and former Whigs and former Democrats to cooperate with each other. And then you had abolitionists in New England to placate, along with slaveholders in Kentucky. How do you get those elements to cooperate with each other? You had teetotalers, prohibitionists, and beer-loving Germans in the Midwest. How do you get them to cooperate with each other? You have free traders who believe there should be no tariffs, and you have protectionists who believe there should be high tariffs. How do you get them to cooperate with each other? And so Lincoln was able to do this because of his tact, because of his unwillingness to quarrel, because of his uncanny ability to rise above the demands of the ego. Now, just the opposite was the case of Jefferson Davis. Jefferson Davis, the president of the Confederacy, was a more traditional political figure. And actually, if you had looked at Jefferson Davis's resume before the Civil War and looked at Lincoln's resume, you would have thought Jefferson Davis would have been a much better war president than Abraham Lincoln. Jefferson Davis had been a graduate of West Point. He had been a war hero in the Mexican War. He had been a successful governor of Mississippi. He had been a senator from Mississippi. He had been a Secretary of War. He had this tremendous resume. Lincoln had been four terms in the Illinois House of Representatives, and that was it for public service. Jefferson Davis, because of his character and personality, was a much less effective president, partly because he quarreled with everybody. He wouldn't take any criticism or any disagreement without resisting. So he quarreled with his vice president. He quarreled with his Congress. He quarreled with his cabinet. He quarreled with his generals. He quarreled with Southern governors. He quarreled with Southern newspaper editors. And the result was Southern unity was badly undermined. Lincoln, however, refused to do that, managed to keep all the units of and various factions of the North united, and without that unity, the North could easily have lost the war. And I'd like to close my formal remarks by sharing with you a statement that Lincoln made, which I think exemplifies this remarkable quality of his leadership. And that's a statement that he made to a young man in the middle of the war in October of 1863. This young man was a captain in the Union Army, and he had been squabbling with his superior officers. Lincoln took time out from his busy schedule to offer this young man some sound paternal advice. And he starts off by quoting from one of his favorite authors, Shakespeare, and from one of his favorite plays, Hamlet. And you may recall in that play that Polonius gives a speech to his son Laertes, who's about to go off to college, and he gives him a lot of advice. Neither a borrower nor a lender be, to thine own self be true, don't run up the cell phone bill, things like that. So Lincoln quotes from that speech, and he says to this young man, he says, "The advice of a father to a son," and then he quotes from Polonius' speech to Laertes and Hamlet, "beware of entrance to a quarrel, but being in, beware that the opposed may beware of thee." Lincoln says that advice is good, and yet not the best. Quarrel not at all. No man determined to make the most of himself can spare time for personal contention. Still less can he afford to take all the consequences, including the vitiating of his temper and the loss of self-control. Yield greater things to which you can show no more than an equal claim, and lesser things, though clearly your own. Better to be bitten by a dog than, better to give your path to a dog than be bitten by him and contesting for the right. even killing the dog would not cure the bite. That statement should be in big gold letters on this building and every building on campus and every post office and every school in the country. Well, I thank you for your attention. I would be happy to try to answer questions or field comments. Yes, sir. What kind of father was Lincoln? Lincoln was a notoriously indulgent father. In fact, he scandalized his Victorian neighbors who believed that children should be seen and not heard. Lincoln really allowed his children to misbehave, to run around, to cause havoc. In fact, one of the most popular exhibits at the Lincoln Presidential Museum in Springfield, I live across the street from it, shows his two boys, the two younger boys, tearing up the office and spilling the inkwells and misbehaving in general. And Lincoln would always say, I don't want the boys subjected to parental tyranny. I think parental tyranny meant something to him because of his own experience with his father. So he was very indulgent, and yet one of the saddest aspects of the Lincoln story is the story of his relationship with his eldest son. The Lincolns, as I said earlier, had four children, all boys, so you have to feel sorry for Mrs. Lincoln, at least for that. And that of those boys, only one survived into adulthood. And by the way, I should say, apropos of Mary Lincoln, that she deserves more to be pitied than censured. That even though she behaved very badly, think what she endured. Her mother died when she was six. It's tough to lose your mother when you're that young. Her father then remarries a much younger woman in short order. And the new wife says to her husband, Mary's father, don't pay any attention to those seven children you had by that dead lady. Pay attention to the eight children we're going to have. So he did. He sired 15 children. Well, every man should have an occupation. And so her father then tunes Mary out in order to placate his new wife. So Mary's abandoned emotionally by her father. Her mother is dead, so she feels like an orphan psychologically. Then she marries. She has four children, as I say, all boys, three of whom die before adulthood. Now, that was not entirely uncommon to lose children in that period, but to lose three or four was uncommon. That's an unusually high percentage. Then to have your husband murdered at your side at the peak of his fame and fortune, that's pretty hard to take too. And then she was manic depressive. It seems clear that that's what she suffered from. And that's something that tends to be genetic. That's not something she asked for. So when you add all that up, you have to agree, I think, that even though the Almighty ladles out a fair amount of misery on all of our plates, she had a particularly heaping portion. Nevertheless, she behaved very badly. That has to be borne in mind. But anyway, to get back to your question, Lincoln and his eldest son were not very close. They weren't estranged the way that Lincoln and his own father had been estranged, but they didn't get along very well. And that's because they had different temperaments, they had different physiques, they had different values, they had different personalities. And that happens sometimes. A parent and a child will be very different. And sometimes a parent and a child will be very similar. Lincoln's third son, for example, Willie, was just like Lincoln. Lincoln's relationship with Willie was very intense, very close. That's because he looked like Lincoln, he had Lincoln's sense of humor, he had Lincoln's values and the like. Willie unfortunately died at the age of 11 in the White House. And that's what happens when you become a parent, as many of you know. You roll the genetic dice when you have children. You can have a child who's just like you, you can have a child who's a Martian, or seems so different, you might as well be from another universe, and you get have anything in between. And it's not the child's fault, and it's not the parent's fault. It's just the way it happens. And I think Lincoln probably derived a great deal of solace from Shakespeare's play King Lear. And you may recall in that play that the Duke of Kent says, apropos of the differences between King Lear's two daughters, on the one side, Goneril and Regan, and the bad daughters, and the good daughter, Cordelia. And the Duke of Kent says, it is the stars above us, govern our conditions. Else oneself, mate and make, could not beget such different issues. In other words, we don't have a whole lot of control over what our children turn out to be like. So I think that was the case with Lincoln, that it was a source of some sorrow to him that he couldn't bond more closely with his eldest son, but he couldn't. Another thing to bear in mind about Lincoln as a father is that he was absent a lot, that he goes out in the spring on the circuit and in the fall on the circuit and doesn't come home on weekends. So Mary Lincoln was, for half the year, in effect, a single mom. So it's a mixed record. Yes, anybody else? Do we have microphones that are being passed around? Do you have one up, question over there? Okay.
What effect did his depression have on his political and emotional life?
What effect did Lincoln's depression have on his political and emotional life? Lincoln was, as you doubtless know, prone to depression. And on two occasions, he was so depressed that his friends feared that he would commit suicide. And they removed from him all sharp objects that he might use to do himself in. That's when his sweetheart, Ann Rutledge, died when Lincoln was in his mid-20s. He was going to get married to this very lovely young woman, and she died. And he was deeply depressed, so depressed that people feared for his life. Again, when he broke off his engagement to Mary Todd when he was 31, again, people feared that Lincoln's depression was so severe that he would kill himself. And those are the two examples of Lincoln being deeply depressed. During the war, and indeed during much of his life, he had a melancholy disposition. He tended to be sad. He tended to be depressive in his approach to life. And I think that that was a result. I try to analyze the origins of that in my books. I speculate that Lincoln's experience of death when he was young, particularly the death of his mother, because you have to imagine, here's Lincoln's a 9-year-old boy, and his mother contracts something called milk sickness. When in a drought period, cattle in southwest Indiana would go deep into the forest. They would eat snake root. Snake root had tremetol in it. It's kind of poison. And if you drank the milk, you got very sick and died. But it took usually a week to die. And you went through, you writhed, you turned black, your tongue turned black, you writhed around. Can you imagine a 9-year-old boy in a cabin with his mother, one-room cabin, spending a week watching your mother die that way? Pretty tough. So now we know from modern clinical psychological studies that the early death of a parent is oftentimes the source of depression in adulthood. There are a lot of other reasons for depression, but that's a fairly fruitful one. And yet that can be offset if the surviving parent is emotionally nurturant and available. But Thomas Lincoln, Lincoln's father, doesn't fit that description. Now we do know that Mrs. Lincoln, the second Mrs. Lincoln, that is Lincoln's stepmother, who came along 15 months after Lincoln's biological mother died, she had a very profound influence on his life. She helped undo a lot of the damage that was done by the early death of Nancy Hanks, his mother. But a lot of damage had been done that didn't get undone. And I think Lincoln's tendency toward depression is rooted in the death not only of his mother, but at the same time his surrogate grandparents, her foster parents, died in the same little community. So imagine losing your mother, your grandmother, and your grandfather all within a week or two at 9 years of age. Then Lincoln's sweetheart dies. Lincoln's baby brother dies in infancy. Lincoln's older sister dies in childbirth when Lincoln was in his late teens. So all these deaths, I think, predisposed him to be depressive. Now, what effect did that have on him? Well, I haven't really explored this, but a good friend of mine has written a book called Lincoln's Melancholy, in which he examines not the origins of Lincoln's depression, but the consequences. And he argues, and I think it's pretty convincing, that Lincoln's compassion, his ability to feel other people's sorrow and to empathize with them, to put himself in their shoes, was dramatically enhanced by the pain and sorrow that he himself had gone through, so that he could sympathize with other people who were depressed or other people who were suffering for other reasons. And I think there's a lot of truth to that. Yes, any other questions? Other microphones? Yeah, there we go. Yes, sir.
Well, first, thank you very much for your presentation this
evening. Thank you.
Secondly, I was just wondering if you could comment on Lincoln's spiritual life.
Yes.
And how perhaps Willie's death was influenced by that, and how we might have seen that in his second inaugural. Thank you.
Okay, Lincoln's spiritual development and how that's particularly reflected in the second inaugural address. I think what we can say about Lincoln's religious views is that it's a tricky subject, but speaking very broadly, Lincoln as a young man was a skeptic. We have to recognize that Lincoln was very smart. That's something we tend to underestimate when we think of Lincoln's virtues, of his compassion and his humanity and his humor and all that. But that Lincoln also had a very high IQ, a very powerful logical mind. And he grew up in a region, rural Kentucky and then rural Southwest Indiana, where there wasn't much intellectual stimulation and there weren't many intellectual companions. And the preachers that he encountered in those areas were oftentimes ignorant, illiterate, often drunk. And so his idea of religion, as it was practiced and preached by these illiterate and disreputable ministers, tended to make him very skeptical. And in fact, when he was a young man in his 20s, he allegedly wrote a pamphlet denying the validity of the scriptures, and his friends threw it in the fire lest it ruin his political career. But then after his midlife crisis, after the death of his second son, Eddie, at the age of 3, and right about the time of the death of his father, Lincoln seems to become less and less skeptical. And that proceeds apace until the death of his beloved favorite child, Willie, in the White House in 1862. And according to Mrs. Lincoln, that really pushed Lincoln into the further away from the skepticism of his youth. And Lincoln had a profound sense of the power of the Almighty. He really believed that there was a God who intervened in the affairs of mankind, who cared about justice, who cared about fair play, and who would intervene. And it wasn't just window dressing. It wasn't just political posturing that led Lincoln to express religious sentiments. And nowhere did he express his religious sentiments more powerfully than he did, as you mentioned, in his second inaugural address, which is widely regarded as his greatest speech, even greater than the Gettysburg Address. And in the second inaugural address, when we think of the second inaugural, we usually think of the final paragraph, with malice toward none, with charity for all, and so forth. But the more remarkable passage in that document, to my way of thinking, is the paragraph that precedes that. And in that paragraph, Lincoln grapples with a question that had been on his mind for some time. And that is, why is the Civil War so bloody? Why have so many men died? Why does it go on so long? When the war started, most everybody believed that it would be short. It wasn't. The number of men who died in the American Civil War was over 600,000, anywhere from 620 to 650 or 70,000. That's on a population base of 30 million. That's a huge, imagine, if you will, that we were in a war today where, with a population of 310 million, we lost 6.5 million men in a war. I mean, that's the scale that you were dealing with. And Lincoln one day wrote a memorandum to himself. Lincoln liked to do this to help clarify his thinking. He would write out passages, not for publication, but just to help sharpen his own understanding of events. And in a memorandum that has survived, he asks these questions, and it starts off by saying, "The will of God prevails." And then I paraphrase, he goes on to say, "I don't understand why God allowed this war to start in the first place. And after having allowed the war to start, I don't allow I don't understand why he allows it to go on and on and on. And so many men are dead, and so many widows and orphans are created. I can't imagine what's on God's mind. So Lincoln thinks about this and thinks about it and thinks about it, and then he comes up with an answer, which he incorporates into the next-to-last paragraph of the second inaugural address. And it goes like this. He starts off by saying, the Almighty has his own purposes. And then he quotes from Jesus according to the Gospel of St. Matthew. Woe unto the world because of offenses, for it must needs be that offenses come. But woe unto that man by whom the offense cometh. Lincoln then says, if we shall suppose that American slavery is one of the offenses which in the providence of God must needs come, but having passed through his appointed time, he now wills to remove, and that he gives to both North and South this terrible war as the woe due unto them by whom the offense came. Shall we discern therein any departure from those divine attributes which believers in a living God have always ascribed to him? Fondly do we hope, fervently do we pray, that this mighty scourge of war may speedily pass away. But if God wills that it continue until all the wealth piled by the bondman's 250 years of unrequited toil shall be sunk, and until every drop of blood drawn with the lash shall be paid by another drawn with the sword, as was said 3,000 years ago, so still it must be said, the judgments of the Lord are true and righteous altogether. Well, that's a startling statement. The Civil War, Lincoln suggests, he doesn't say this is definitely the case, but he suggests the Civil War is God's punishment on white people for having enslaved black people. And that the war will go on until the scales are balanced, until all those back wages of 250 years of unrequited toil shall be compensated by an amount of destruction of white property equal to those back wages. And until all the blood shed by the slave owner's whip or the overseer's whip shall be paid by another drop of white blood shed in the war, then and only then will the war end. Now, Lincoln doesn't say that that's definitely the case, but what he does suggest is it might well be the case, in which, and if it is, all we can do is agree with the psalmist, the judgments of the Lord are true and righteous altogether. Well, if that had been said by a Presbyterian minister, say, on a Sunday sermon, that's one thing. But for a president to say that in an inaugural address, it's extraordinary. So clearly, he did believe that there was a superintending providence, and that that superintending providence cared about justice and intervened in the affairs of men. And that's a huge leap from the skepticism that he had expressed as a youth. And I think that progression, that evolution from skepticism to a kind of prophetic vision was certainly helped by the death of his sons, Eddie and then Willie. That helped propel him into a more profound reflection upon spiritual life and religion in general. Yes, and this gentleman here.
I had a question. My memory may be incorrect, but I think in 1863 or maybe 1864, Lincoln met secretly on a riverboat and expressed the opinion that, given the carnage that had taken place up to this point, that he would rather save the Union and compromise on slavery. What did I remember that incorrectly, or what's your
point? In 1864, when Lincoln was running for re-election, the Democrats made a big to-do about the fact that Lincoln had said in the middle of 1864, when Southerners made some kind of peace overtures, he said, I'd be happy to have to meet with anybody from the Confederacy who's got the power to really make a deal and negotiate, with the understanding that there are three criteria that have to be met unconditionally. One, the war has to stop. You have to lay down your arms. You have to agree to rejoin the Union. And you have to agree to abide by the Emancipation Proclamation. And the Democrats said, well, that third condition, that you have to abide by the Emancipation Proclamation, which, by the way, is here on my tie, along with a little dinner, I see, that the people said, now, wait a minute. The Democrats said, this war could end if Lincoln would just accept the fact that the Confederates will lay down their arms and rejoin the Union. But no, he says they've got to agree to the emancipation of slavery. So all these white folks are being asked to go out and get killed to free black folks. And you know, we joined the army in huge numbers, not because we were abolitionists who wished to see slavery abolished, but we were Unionists who wanted to see the Union preserved. And Lincoln was told by his campaign manager, by the governors of the northern states, look, you've got to back down on this, you know, retract that, because the Democrats are making that statement the staple of their political campaigning. And so Lincoln does toy with the idea, and he actually writes a letter, which he doesn't send, in which he suggests that he might back down. And he meets with his campaign staff and his campaign chairman, and they thrash it out, and Lincoln says, no, can't do that. So he was tempted, because apparently he thought that his re-election, which meant, and he believed that if he were defeated for re-election, that no Democrat was going to pursue the war to the end and that slavery would still exist, that it was worth it. But he finally decided, no, it's not worth it, and he would stick by emancipation as an absolute prerequisite for peace. But you're right in thinking that he was tempted. Budge, how long should we? One more. Okay, final question. Do we have a gentleman here? I'm sorry. I'm told I only have one more question, and I did.
Yes. As you say, in his diary, he really wanted to stick out for the black and to abolish the slavery. However, after the Civil War, he didn't do anything to help the black slaves to get their citizenship and voting rights, all those kinds of things. So the black people didn't know what to do after they're free.
Well, the question is, what about Lincoln and black rights? And not just the elimination of slavery, but black voting rights, civil rights, and the like. Well, here's a little known fact that should be emphasized. On April 11th, 1865, this was 2 days after Robert E. Lee surrendered, so the war was, for all intents and purposes, over. Lincoln gives a public speech, and the public expects that Lincoln will urge congratulations to the Army and the Navy, and let's have an orgy of national self-congratulation. Lincoln doesn't do that. On April 11th, 1865, Lincoln gives a very sober speech about Reconstruction. What will we do now that the war is over? What about the 11 southern states? What do they have to do in order to get back into the Union? And for the first time, publicly, something that he had done privately a year earlier, but now, for the first time publicly, Lincoln says, I believe black people should be allowed to vote, at least those who have served in the army and those who are very intelligent, by which we assume he meant literate. This was a tremendous turning point in the evolution of Lincoln's public stance on black rights. Now, Frederick Douglass, the leading black abolitionist and orator of the time, was in the audience that day. And he said that he and his abolitionist friends, when they heard Lincoln call for black voting rights, limited black voting rights to be sure, were disappointed because they were so limited. That is, only the very intelligent, and only the veterans of the Union Army. And he said, we abolitionists failed to appreciate how significant that was, because Abraham Lincoln learned his statesmanship in the school of rail splitting. And to split a rail, you take a wedge and you insert the thin edge of the wedge into a log. And having done that, then you take a giant hammer, a maul, and you drive home the thick edge of the wedge. And what we should have known that day on April 11th, 1865, is Lincoln was inserting the thin edge of the wedge. And we should have known, based on what he had done in the previous 4 years, that having inserted the thin edge of the wedge, you could count on him to drive home the thick edge of the wedge. That's a brilliant image, and I think it's true. There was, however, one member of the audience who did appreciate the significance of Lincoln's call for black voting rights, and that was a charismatic young actor named John Wilkes Booth. And when he heard Lincoln call for black voting rights, he said to his companions, and you'll pardon my quoting some unpleasant language, he said, "That means nigger citizenship. That's the last speech he's ever going to give. By God, I'm going to run him through." And 3 days later, he followed through on that threat. So Abraham Lincoln was murdered, not because he issued the Emancipation Proclamation, not because, which only freed the slaves in the Confederate States. Abraham Lincoln was not murdered because he endorsed the 13th Amendment and worked hard to get that passed through Congress, abolishing slavery everywhere, not just in the Confederate States, but also in the loyal slave states of Kentucky, Maryland, Delaware, and Missouri. Lincoln wasn't murdered for endorsing the 13th Amendment. Lincoln was murdered because he called for black voting rights. And therefore, I think it's appropriate for us in the 21st century to regard Lincoln as a martyr to black civil rights, as much as Martin Luther King or Medgar Evers or any of the others who were murdered in the 1960s as they champion the civil rights revolution of our own time. Once again, I thank you for your attention.